As we grow up, we learn certain truths even though we don't know why they are true. For example, since both my parents from Boston, growing up, I knew that the Red Sox couldn't win the World Series, even though I didn't know why they couldn't, and it just proved to be a fact confirmed by experience that they couldn't. And growing up in any English-speaking, and I dare say even Western land, it was just a truth that everybody knew that the greatest writer in the world was William Shakespeare. Now, when you came to Shakespeare in high school, it was very hard to figure out just what this guy was talking about. And despite the assurances of your teachers that this was really great, it just seemed as though he was writing in a language we didn't understand, even though it was supposed to be ours. And of course, what happens to most of us is that having had that experience in high school, we are reluctant to ever return to him later. But if, in fact, you read Shakespeare or read about Shakespeare, you will at least discover that which, for hundreds of years, people have considered not just exceptional, but virtually unique. Among all the millions and millions of people, many of them brilliant, some of them geniuses, who have taken a pen or pencil to paper or parchment or computer to screen and tried to write. First, people will tell you that Shakespeare used, and it is true because now we have computers and we know, a larger vocabulary by far than any writer who ever lived. Most of it specialized vocabulary for different trades and professions, and to this day, people don't know how it was that Shakespeare, who had not much education, knew more about everything than almost anybody else in his time or later. It is also true that Shakespeare inhabits his characters, becomes them. And there is almost no one who's forgettable. There are no throwaway characters in Shakespeare. If he's portraying a gravedigger in that one short speech, he tells you what it's like to be a gravedigger in a way that is unforgettable. But of late, literary critics have been emphasizing something different about what makes Shakespeare unique. Something that Shakespeare introduced into literature that really did not exist before him. And that is that Shakespeare wrote what people are thinking in a way that made you believe that these were really their thoughts. It's not that nobody ever wrote so-and-so thought this, but to actually write a soliloquy that looked and read and you could feel was what went on inside of people, that was different. And you can trace, as a new book called Will in the World does, the development of Shakespeare's learning how to do this very gradually. In the early soliloquies, such as Richard III, they're very powerful soliloquies where he gets up in front of the audience and he speaks what he's thinking, but you can still feel that he's talking to an audience about what he's thinking and not really just thinking it. Richard II is greater, and then there is that remarkable piece of work, what many, if not most, consider Shakespeare's greatest play, which is Hamlet. And in Hamlet, the soliloquies really are, the person who watches the play believes, what Hamlet is thinking. The jumps and pirouettes and dives and digressions and subtle meandering themes of his thought, that's really how someone thinks. And no one before Shakespeare, and very few people after, have managed to convince us when they say this is what the character is thinking, that that's really how we think. In the course of the few minutes that I've been speaking, your thoughts have branched off in 1,000 different directions. Imagine if you had to write that down and explain it to someone else in a way that they would believe and understand it. He does this through language, but it wasn't until I read this excerpt from Greenblatt's book that I understood that Shakespeare also does it through silence. And this is the point to which I wanted to arrive, or at which I wanted to arrive, that is, that part of what Shakespeare does to show thoughts is leave things out. He doesn't always make connections between one thought and another, so that the audience starts to participate in the thinking along with the character. Shakespeare declines to spell out every single step that Hamlet takes to get to this end point. And so we start thinking with him. And it's not just that the character on the stage is thinking, but, remarkably enough, he has gotten the audience to think. And so does the Bible. This is the technique, as was realized many years ago, that the Bible uses to draw us into its characters. This is why there is Midrash. This is why there's rabbinic explanation of the Bible, because at critical points when you would expect a full recounting of exactly what the characters thought, the Bible says nothing. What did Abraham think when all of a sudden a voice came out of the sky and said, "Go"? We have no idea. But because we are human beings, of course, we have thousands of ideas. And that makes us participants in the Bible story. We all know the Midrashic tale. People are always surprised to find out that it's not actually in the Torah, of Abraham breaking his father's idols. Right? His father's an idol maker. Abraham breaks them all. His father comes the next morning, says what happened. Abraham says they got into a fight. His father says, "Stone doesn't fight." And Abraham says, "So why do you pray to it?" It's a great story. And it's one way of trying to close the gap between nothing, because after all, Abraham is nothing before this, and all of a sudden, he's the founder of a people. I want to tell you a different Midrashic story, though, that has more to do with how Abraham thinks, and I hope, with how we think. This fills in the gap in another way. There is a Midrash that says that what happened was Abraham looked around the world, and the world seemed to him like a palace. And that palace was Doleket. I'll come back to that word in a second. And looking at this palace, Abraham said, "Could there be such a palace and no owner? Does nobody superintend? Does nobody care for this palace that is the world?" And at that point, God came out of the sky and said, "Lech lecha." I've been waiting to be summoned by somebody who would have this question. And now that it's happened, Abraham, you and I together will change the world. Now the word doleket, in the way, incidentally, that this Midrash is recounted in our Chumash, in the Eitz Chaim, the word doleket means illuminated, full of light. And so what does the Midrash mean? According to this reading, it means Abraham looked at the world and he saw that it was beautiful. He saw mountains and trees. He saw animals and people. He saw skies and stars. And he said, this is such a magnificent place. Somebody must take care of it. And God said, I'm the one. But as Abraham Joshua Heschel pointed out, Doleket can also mean on fire. And so it is possible that Abraham looked at the world and he said, the world is burning down. All I see is tragedy. All I see is pain and suffering and disease and death. Does nobody care about this? And God said, I've been waiting for somebody to feel that way. So here we have the two ways of coming to God. You can come to God through joy, and you can come to God through tragedy. Abraham experiences God when he has a child, and who doesn't know, who has ever had a child, the sense that as you hold this brand new child, you know what it is to have an experience of God. I mean, there it is. How remarkable it is. A few moments ago, there were three people in the room, and now there are four. It's unbelievable. And in that new life is clearly the intent of God, and in our joy, the confirmation of God's presence in the world. And yet, who hasn't felt tragedy and wondered and searched in that moment? And sometimes, perhaps, repeated in one way or another the words of the psalmist, Mima'amakim karatiya, from out of the depths I have called to you, God. And felt, if we are lucky and if we are faithful in our hearts, Anani v'merchavya, you have answered me and set me free. Like Abraham, we reach to God in times of joy and in times of pain. There is an old saying that there are no atheists in foxholes. That when you're in war and somebody's shooting at you, everybody prays. It's not entirely true, but you know the idea. That when we're afraid, we turn to God. But I wonder, are there any atheists in labor and delivery wards? If you are fortunate enough to hold in your hands a healthy child, you feel God's presence. And if, God forbid, it is otherwise, you seek God's presence too. Jewish history, Jewish writing is full of these two understandings of Doleket. The book of Job is all about the house burning down. At the beginning of the book, remember, Job is the most fortunate man in the world. He has everything, and he believes in God. At the end of the book, he has gone through every conceivable tragedy, and his faith is deeper. Despite the questioning, the fear, the anger, the resentment, the sense of betrayal that threads its way through the book, at the end of the book, Job feels closer to God, not farther away, because now he has seen the palace when it is lit and the palace when it burns. You know, in the Amidah, we say, Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And the Baal Shem Tov said, why don't you just say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Why the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob? His answer is that every one of them had their own relationship to God. Abraham's relationship to God wasn't like Isaac's, wasn't like Jacob's, wasn't like yours, wasn't like mine. But one thing about all of their relationships is the same. They were all surprising. Abraham suddenly hears a voice come out of the sky. Isaac is told that his father is commanded by God to sacrifice him. And remember what Jacob says when he lays his head on a rock in Beit El, which becomes Beit El. Achein yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. What do you know? There's a God in this place and I didn't realize it. A true, deep relationship to God is always a surprise. It happens in ways you don't expect. Doors are opened that you didn't know. Sometimes, because all of a sudden in your life, everything is going along fine, and you get a phone call, and the palace is burning. Sometimes, because you get a phone call, and the palace is lit up. But either way, there is God in that moment. And if we are fortunate enough and awake enough and we have bitachon, which remember means trust, then maybe at times when the palace is burning or the palace is filled with light, we will hear a voice like Abraham's that says, Lech Lecha, this is your journey, this is your path, and you can go. For no matter what happens in your life, fire and light, you will know, as did our first father, that God is with you. Shabbat Shalom.